Tonight on Arena, Tara Brady speaks to us live from this year's Cannes Film Festival, and in movie reviews, it's Deerskin, Summer of Soul, and Nowhere Special. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The Cannes Film Festival, founded in 1946, is now in its 75th year. And obviously the last few years constitute a turbulent period for the movie business, perhaps even more so than other industries, as the impact of the pandemic has forced a fundamental shift in thinking about the way films are delivered to audiences. But for attendees at this year's Cannes Film Festival, the message does seem to be that movies, no matter how they are consumed, are very much back in business. One of the lucky attendees at this year's Cannes Film Festival is Tara Brady, who joins me now from the beautiful French Riviera. It's a very tough job, I know, Tara, and thank you so much for doing it for us.
Yeah, I should mention it's also 27 degrees over here.
Excuse me now. It's a very pleasant 24 or 25 here at home, let me tell you, Ms. Okay. Brady.
And I just, out of just randomly, a car just drove past my window, a Bentley with Rick Astley's Never Going to Give You Up blasting out the thing. So it's that kind of vibe everywhere, all over Cannes. Yesterday, of course, was Bastille Day. So on every street corner, there was music. You know, there was organ music pouring out of like churches, and then you'd go up to the actual Croisette, and there's all the kind of carnival music and disco music, and it was all pretty wild partying, and it all ended with very, very spectacular fireworks last night.
Yeah, and that's also to make your job even more difficult. You had to dine fish and vegetable. I'm saying supper, but perhaps it was much more extravagant than all of that with the mayor of Cannes.
Well, I didn't go. I will say I was busy working, being diligent, being a very good noodle, and also I'm vegan, so fish suppers are of no use to me. But that's the scale of the event here yesterday. The mayor invited every single accredited member of press to come and have fresh local produce, fish and vegetables, along the seafront. So that's very much the message here, that everything is back to normal. The movies are back in business, and everyone is outside dining and wearing ball gowns, and they're driving up and down in their fancy cars. So you do actually have this kind of party atmosphere. But behind that, there is a lot. There are very, very strict. There's a massive COVID operation. You need a PCR, obviously, to enter France at the moment. And you also need to be tested every 48 hours to attend screenings and press conferences. So when you go in, your ticket is scanned, your press badge is scanned, and your COVID status is scanned at every single event. And there's no social distancing in cinemas here, but you cannot remove your mask. So basically, to do the sums for you, because it takes 6 hours for your PCR to come back, you're getting tested every 42 hours.
Wow.
So, but they take it very, very, very seriously. Yeah. If you haven't had a test in the last 48 hours, you do not enter the cinema.
Well, that's fair enough. And I just have one thing on that, Tara. I'm wondering about, because it's a while since we've all sat in a cinema. And if we have been at press screenings, even, we're looking at, you know, a small press corps being very socially distanced. We haven't been in an audience where people are sitting beside each other. So even though you have your mask on, is it a very, you know, is there something comforting? Is it a very different experience with a packed auditorium looking up at a screen as opposed to a socially distanced auditorium?
Well, I had a really lovely experience today, because Tilda Swinton was five rows behind me at the big, you know, sort of 2,000-seater cinema, the Lumiere, and that was really interesting, because it had all the talent had come in and the press were there, and again it was a very, very nice atmosphere. Obviously people are wearing masks, but interestingly the A-listers are not wearing masks, obviously, on the red carpet, or they couldn't they couldn't do all those nice photoshoots shots that make news headlines all around the world, and we wouldn't have had all those shots of frocks, and we've had quite a few of those, and you get the real sense that people have been sitting there looking longingly at their wardrobe and just waiting to bust out a frock and finally they have their chance. And you know, so we've had an awful lot of glamour this year, and we've had We've had Timothy in his silver dinner jacket, and then we've had Tilda Swinton in white on several occasions. Today she was wearing this billowing white shirt dress that went down to her navel that looked very fabulous and made her look even more statuesque than usual. And we had Sharon Stone in that big Dolce & Gabbana 3D floral gown that I guess must have been on every newspaper in the world yesterday.
Because initially I heard about Sharon Stone in a floral dress and I thought, a floral dress? How is that making all? And then I realised, oh, it's a 3D floral dress. It's not just some Laura Ashley print. There are big flowers on this dress.
Yes.
And yeah. I guess, you know, it's easy to laugh at all of that side of it and the glamour and the glitz. But I presume this year, more so than any other year, Tara, there's a sense in which that glamour and glitz is part of the we're back in business statement.
Well, definitely. And, you know, you have to remember, like, the Oscars this year was virtual, which isn't the same. You don't get that kind of big, you know, sweep up the red carpet that you do with the, you know, you just get sort of like little bits of an outfit. You don't get the full thing. And same with every other award ceremony for the last 12 months. So there really hasn't been an event of this scale in the movie business. You know, and after all, it is show business. And by golly, they can put on a show.
Yeah, and that I suppose is part of what they're trying to do. Any talk about people not being allowed to wear flat shoes or the like? Because that had caused some consternation in recent years, and possibly on a more serious note, the film festival criticised for its lack of diversity across films and indeed on the jury as well. Has that been addressed? Just casting your eye across the programme, do you think that's been addressed in some way this year?
Well, they definitely do have a few female filmmakers like Maya Hansen Love, who's here with Bergman Island, in the main competition. They're probably not as many as there should be, but they've definitely done. They're definitely mindful of it. There was that famous incident in 2015 where they turned women away, one of whom had a medical condition, if you remember the story, because they were wearing flat shoes and they couldn't countenance somebody coming into a black tie screening that wasn't wearing high heels. And there was also to compound it in that year and the year after, as very, very kind of lopsided programs in terms of, you know, race and gender and all those kinds of metrics. But this year we have Spike Lee. He is the first African-American to be president of the jury. So that's a big deal. And the jury for the first time in Cannes history is a majority female jury. So you have the actress Melanie Laurent, Maggie Gyllenhaal, you have the Austrian director Jessica Hausner, and you have the French actress and director Mathieu Diop, and French singer Mylene Farmer. So there's also been a few other things in terms of like the sidebars, and there was a new documentary and a sidebar of films from Oscar Michaud, who, if you've heard of him, and a lot of people haven't, he was the first African-American film director. He made more than 44 films before his death in 1951. But he's been largely written out of history, and that's been addressed by the festival. There was also tonight a newly restored print of a really extraordinary film in the Cannes Classics selection, which is one that was only put out on TV in America, but when Cannes saw it, you know, back in the early 80s, they snapped it up and put it in the festival. The film is Bill Jukes' The Killing Floor, and I suppose the best way to describe it is it's like an African-American version of Warren Beatty's Reds. It's this big historical film in terms of it has that kind of sweep and ambition, but it certainly wouldn't have had the budget that Warren Beatty had. But not that you'd ever notice it, because it makes really clever use of archive footage and history. And what it does is it chronicles black sharecroppers who leave Mississippi and go to the Chicago stockyards to work the jobs that are vacated by soldiers who've gone off to the First World War. And those jobs are in meatpacking, which is, you can only imagine the conditions at that point in time for people in that industry and the wages, and the workers, you know, slowly come together and form the rather grandly named Amalgamated Meat Cutters and Butcher Workmen of North America Union. And it's all of the struggle about that and all of the arguments around that. A really, really, really extraordinary film. So that's one of the things they're doing. They're digging things out of the archives and doing very, very good restoration work.
Obviously, you know, I know that the situation situation is different in terms of, you say you're not socially distanced in cinemas, but I believe the queues of old, you were almost like, it was like cattle, particularly for the journalists who were there, they were kind of shoved into this waiting, holding area, if you like, and everybody was on top of each other. But I guess in those scenarios, that was often where the buzz about a film would start to trickle out. You'd be hearing somebody talking about a screening they'd been to. How are you hearing and what are you hearing about the films that are causing a buzz this year?
Well, there are always in Cannes, which there are specialised publications that only come out in Cannes. Mm. So you get a special version of the big trade newspapers like Screen International and Variety. They come out here in kind of daily editions, and they pull together, they do kind of a meta-analysis of all the reviews in all the major newspapers and outlets across the world. And from there, you can immediately see the films that have huge buzz about them and the films that, you know, that aren't doing so well. So, for example, there's quite a bit of buzz around Annette and quite a bit of buzz around Bergman Island. And then there's not so much buzz around Arnaud Desplein's Deception, which is based on the Philip Roth novel and stars Léa Seydoux, who's a notable absentee this year because she couldn't come because she tested positive for COVID. It hasn't got the reviews that maybe you would have expected it.
Were you there for the Wes Anderson for the French Dispatch, which had its premiere earlier this week? Did you get to see that?
No, I'm going to see that on Saturday. So they do secondary screenings. So I'll be doing catch up on that on Saturday. But it does look very much like a Wes Anderson film. It has all the usual Wes Anderson people in it. And when they come around to do the sort of galleries of the movie stars who were in attendance at the thing, I'd say probably half of them are in the Wes Anderson movie, because we had Bill Murray and we had Tim Tay, of course, and we had Benicio del Toro. So yes, that made up for a sizable contingent of starry stars on the red carpet this year.
Let's have a clip featuring the aforementioned Timothée. I love the way you say that. Timothée Chalamet has Zeffirelli in this clip. The French Dispatch had its premiere earlier this week, Tara going later this week. Frances McDormand is playing Lucinda Crements in this scene. Lucinda has walked into the bathroom. Zeffirelli is taking a bath, and usually you don't have clothes on in the bath, that's fair enough. But to be pedantic, this, like some of the scenes in the trailer, is in black and white. So whatever that means as you're listening to this clip, listen in black and white if you can.
I'm naked, Mrs. Crements.
I can see that.
Why are you crying?
Tear gas. Also, I suppose I'm sad.
Please turn away, I feel shy about my new muscles.
Go tell your parents you're home. They're worried.
I'm expected back on the barricades.
I didn't see any barricades.
Well, we're still constructing them.
Uh-huh. What are you writing?
Our manifesto. I told them not to invite Paul, by the way. Maybe you're sad, but you don't seem lonely to me.
Exactly.
I saw you at the protest on top of a bookcase taking notes. Is there a story in us for the people of Kansas?
Maybe.
Then you should study our resolutions. Or anyway, will you proofread it? My parents think you're a good writer.
Give it to me. It's a little damp.
Physically or metaphorically?
Both, based on the cover and the first four sentences.
Don't criticize my manifesto.
Oh, you don't want remarks?
I don't need remarks, do I? I only asked you to proofread it because I thought you'd be even more impressed by how good it already is.
Let's start with the typos.
The French Dispatch there, Frances McDormand and Timothée Chalamet in a scene from the film that got its premiere at the Cannes Film Festival earlier this week. Tara Brady in Cannes this evening. So what are you looking forward to? I hope you'll be looking forward to that particular secondary screening when you get to it. What else are you looking forward to, and what is causing a buzz from where you're getting it, Tara?
Well, I'm really looking forward to Bruno Demont's France. He's a, like, obviously a very big, divisive director. I think we talked about his Joan of Arc musical earlier this year. His two-part Joan of Arc musical earlier this year. He's one of those directors that started off in part of the new French extreme, but he's over the last number of years kind of mutated into this strange comedy director. But France looks as kind of grand and as ambitious as the title, so I'm very much looking forward to that. I'm very much looking forward to Annette, the Sparks musical with Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard. I've already seen the new film from, you're going to have to bear with me, Apichat, Vera Astatkul, the Thai director who won already with Uncle Boonie a couple of years ago. And he's kind of indicative of like part of the kind of back to business plan. There's a real sense that Cannes have pulled out all the big guns and they've got all the big auteurs back. But his Memoria was in competition today with Tilda Swinton as a woman who hears a strange noise and goes to investigate it, and all is not as it seems. And then we have Sean Baker's Red Rocket, which is about a porn star played by an aging porn star. So that was a heap of fun this morning as well.
It sounds like it. Well, listen, I know you're working, Tara. I know it's not all fun and games. So enjoy what you can of the good, the upside of it, and the social side of it, as well as getting to see some films in a cinema with people sitting around you. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Tara Brady reporting to us from this year's Cannes Film Festival. To film this Sunday, or this Thursday evening, it's a sunny Thursday evening for your consideration this week, Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised, to give it its full title, is a found footage feature documentary about a pivotal New York soul music festival which took place in 1969, based on a true story. Second film we have stars James Norton. Nowhere Special follows a terminally ill father as he attempts to find a new home for his young son. And finally, Deerskin, a surrealist horror starring Jean Dujardin as a man who becomes obsessed by his relationship with his new jacket. Casting their critical eye over this week's releases are Gemma Cray and Paul Whittington. And let's start off with Summer of Soul. I'm going to give you a little bit of context here just by simply playing this clip. Summer of Soul was 1969. What was the things like in America at that time? Have a listen.
A day after the death of Dr. Martin Luther King, in more than 100 cities, violence broke out.
After the assassination of Martin Luther King, many an inner city, from Detroit to Philadelphia to Atlanta, like, places were just erupting in anger, righteous anger.
It's too late now. We are ready to start. We're going to finish it up.
Not wanting to repeat what happened the summer of 68, the city allowed for this festival to happen just to have something sort of constructive and like, okay, whew, made it the whole summer without one broken storefront.
It was a crazy, crazy, crazy period. We needed something to really reach out and touch us. We needed that music.
A little clip there from the beginning of Summer of Soul, documentary about a festival that took place in Harlem in 1969. And of course, Gemma Cray, one of our viewers, along with Paul Whittington this evening, there was a small festival happening just up the road, well, 100 miles up the road as well, but that we know loads about, but we don't hear so much about this one, the big festival being Woodstock, of course.
Yeah, only 100 miles away, with probably double the attendees, Woodstock was happening. And it's really funny, I went through the lineup of this festival that no one has heard of. So even the director himself admitted he's Amir Caleb Thompson, and he is the drummer from The Roots, and he's kind of known professionally by his musician name, which is Questlove. And he hadn't heard of the festival, and he's based out of New York, and this is his realm. So I think he admitted that when he heard that this festival had taken place and that there's footage of it that had never been made into a documentary, he took it upon himself to use his connections in the media world and got it across the line. So yeah, and when you go through the lineup of the festival, it is incredible.
Yeah, give us a sense of some of the names that we get there. B.B. King is one, Fifth Dimension another. What stood out for you?
Nina Simone, Gladys Knight, Sly and the Family Stone, Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
There's the incredible gospel choirs. Like, it just... Incredible.
Yeah. I have to say, I found just watching and listening to some of the gospel choirs incredibly emotional, just the sheer power of it all, Paul. That's what this is. You kind of go, Why isn't this festival happening every single year, all the time?
Yeah, especially when you compare it to the, you know, self-congratulatory hippie orgy that was going on up in Woodstock. This took place over six consecutive weekends. And Questlove, as he's usually called, has done a brilliant job in pulling all this together into what seems like a seamless concert. But it is, emotion is the thing. And he very cleverly weaves in context. You've just given us some of it there. But he talks about how Martin Luther King's death had changed the mood totally, and the Panthers. In fact, there were Panthers doing security inside the gig. The Black Power movement had started, but it's a fantastic documentary, but it's full of these incredibly emotional musical moments, because people were angry.
Yeah, and that sense of anger is there, but is it political as well as artistic that we're getting here, Gemma? You know, in other words, which is to the foremost? Is it really celebrating the artists and what they were doing on stage, or is it all the time underpinned by the politics of what was going on in the background?
I mean, those artists were playing under with the background of everything that was happening.
Yeah.
It was such a tumultuous time. I mean, that the artists will talk about it themselves. Nina Simone gives a very impassioned spoken word poem/ballad that brings the audience to tears. So it's very much so deeply, deeply ingrained in what was happening. And it was like the attendees themselves describe it as life changing, as life altering, and yet it somehow managed to be erased from history and forgotten about, which is probably the most shocking thing at all. Like when they went to sell the footage, the producer of the festival and the founder of the festival, Tony Lawrence and Hal Dutchin, he couldn't find anyone to buy it. And you actually look at this lineup, there are musicians here that are still being played, that founded movements. Well, Woodstock, yes, it was a good lineup and I would have definitely had a great time had I have gone. But if you actually go through it, how many people are still being played today?
Yeah, and the other thing about this festival was it really was a festival of the people. Like people talk, several of the attendees talk about, you know, walking from home to get to this festival. They could walk down the street a couple of blocks away and they were there. And one man I would like to mention, because we don't get to do this too often, Republican mayor of New York at the time, John Lindsay, extraordinary on the basis of what we hear and see about him in this film, Paul.
He was very popular in Harlem. He was a very progressive man. He was a member of that now extinct species, the Liberal Republican. And he left the Republican Party about a year after this. But him coming on stage was an amazing moment. But it's the crowds, all these amazingly dressed people. And this is in their borough, which they're very proud of, their neighbourhood, which is much maligned at the time then and probably less so now. People just talk about garbage and crime and drugs, and the heroin problem was starting there in a big way. But these people are so proud of this event, and the communication between artists and audience is extraordinary, especially when you compare it to Woodstock, not to pick on Woodstock.
And the other, there's a young, he's, I don't know what age he would be now, he was a young man, a young boy, Musa Jackson, back in 1969. I think he said he was, I can't remember what age he said he was at the time, but he talks about he'd never seen, and several of the attendees say this, Gemma, he'd never seen so many black people together in the one place. And these are the sort of emotional statements that I must say I found very moving in the film.
And there's a brilliant moment as well. One of the other attendees, just Sly and the Family Stone, came on stage. He didn't know them. And he was commenting. He was like, there were these two white guys on stage. What were they doing there?
So I enjoyed it. I think the pair of you did too. What are you saying about it overall and stars, Gemma?
So I think this is the inspiring reclaiming of black history that we all need right now, given the way the world is going. And I give it 5 stars.
5 from you. What are you saying, Paul?
Yeah, and 5 for me as well. It's a remarkable documentary. It's so well put together. And there is one moment in it when Mavis Staples and Mahalia Jackson sing Martin Luther King's favourite gospel song. And it is extraordinarily powerful.
Yeah, so the double 5. 5 out of 5 mm-hmm. from both of you. So the full star rating there from both Paul and Gemma for the first of our movies this evening, Summer of Soul. Let's move on then to Nowhere Special. you couldn't find a more different film here if you tried. Umberto Pasolini is the director. Small story, slow emotional family integration set in Belfast, starring James Norton, who I think is amazing in this, I have to say. This is an international filmmaker, Gemma, but he's inspired by an article in the Daily Mail to make this film. Just fill us in the background to the film.
So the film tells the true story, and based on a true story, and it follows John, who's a terminally ill window cleaner, who is trying to spend his last few months finding a home for his son. Now, the article was just a headline, and he couldn't really get any more information than what was there. So it's very loosely inspired by that story. But I mean, he does stick very closely to the headline. But I mean, it's as emotional and weighty as you think it is, definitely, from that description. So he interviews a host of different families with the help of some very caring care workers who are helping him out on the case. And he's trying to figure out what is the best life for his son going forward without him, and kind of having a little look into what possibilities are there, and kind of what his son didn't have growing up with him. So it's beautiful, and it's very sad.
Yeah, well, here, let's listen to, I think this is the very first family, in fact, that he's brought to visit. That's the character of John, played by James Norton, brought to visit this particular family. The son, Michael, played by a young actor called Daniel Lamont, and he's meeting a couple called Celia and Philip, played by Valine Kane and Keith McAlane, and they're talking about what they would be able to give to his son. And also with them here is the social worker Shona. You'll hear her in the background. She's played by Eileen O'Higgins.
Does he like nature? We're very outdoorsy people. We like to go for long walks, as you can see. We were thinking about maybe getting a dog.
I know Michael would love a puppy to be responsible for.
Great. We sort of hope the boy would enjoy the same childhood as ourselves, not just inside on the computer all day. And here he's free to run around, not be mollycoddled, free to climb trees and fall out of trees. I mean, we'll look after him, obviously, but you know what I mean.
No, I'm sure he loved to climb trees. He's a quiet wee boy, but he listens, and he's always well behaved. He's very popular at school. I'm always being told what a great kid he is. He's loving Curran. He's a happy wee boy. He deserves a normal family. Two parents, a loving family home, and all the opportunities I never had as a child.
Look at that one as well. Oh. You bang your head, are you all right?
I'm all right.
You sure? Are you sure?
I want him to be able to do all the things I never could, never even thought of.
You understand that.
And that's James Norton there as the dad, John, in that scene from Nowhere Special. You also heard Keith McAlane, Valine Kane as the potential new parents for the little boy, Michael, played by Daniel Lamont. Even as you listen to that, I have to say, this had all the potential to be smolty, to be melodramatic, to be overdone, and for your emotions to be manipulated. Mm. But somehow it avoids all of those traps. Well, for me anyway, Paul.
It really does. I mean, it would be almost impossible to watch if it was to go for that. But it does two things, I think. There's two reasons for that. The first is you arrive in the middle of the story. We don't have to go through the diagnosis and him going through that. That's one thing. And the second thing is the way Norton approaches it. Because he's not breaking down. He's keeping himself together. A lot of the time, there are a couple of key short speeches late on in which we find out what he worries about. But mostly, he's just coping. And the little boy is brilliant in it. The huge look eyes. And he has these killer lines too. Like, he comes from an appointment to the hospital to the carer, and the little boy says, "You're late." And then another time he tries to explain to him, if you wanted to live somewhere else one day, and says, "I like home." So he can't get past him. And of course, he's only 5 or 6, but he's starting to figure it out.
Yeah, he knows that there's something up. The other thing is, in terms of the people that John, the father, has brought to Gemma, he's brought to several different families. And, you know, some of them you could say, yeah, that's a good situation. That's a less good situation. That's a not bad situation. But they all have in some ways good reasons, and you went, well, I found myself, I didn't judge the couples, and some of them, even though their reasons might have been dubious, you kind of, you felt some empathy with them.
Yeah, there's the wife of a postman who's played by the nun from Derry Girls. I can't think of her name, but it's a very different role from her. Gives this beautiful speech, very emotional, and probably exactly what the rest of the film is lacking, that over exposition. But she kind of tells this really sad story about how they were trying for a child and the difficulties of that for her. So all of these characters are real and have these like deep, deep backstories. And obviously Pasolini, who wrote it, really thought about them and created the world. Like, and that's what I actually think really stands out for this, is the writing. At these key pivotal moments where Norton is really internalizing things, he uses the visual aspects of the city, of the soundscape, of having Norton look to pass a gravestone at and look at it and kind of laugh to himself. And there are these moments that really, it's skillful writing, I think.
Yeah, Siobhan McSweeney is the character, the actor you were speaking about there from Derry Girls, and she does that. And there's another scene with a very uptight couple, and yet even though you said don't let your child anywhere near them, but by the end of that scene again, you kind of feel,
I know, I did judge
they had
them.
Their reasons. Did you? Oh, you did judge them, Paul, did you?
Yeah, do you know why? Because they asked them to give the cuddly toy back at the end, for God's sake.
Yeah, they give a toy and then they ask for it back.
You can't do that.
No, you certainly can't do that. It really depends. It sits on the shoulders of James Norton and Daniel Lamont, and to a certain extent Eileen O'Higgins, who is the social worker, or the person helping him look for the adoption. It sits on their three shoulders. They give, well, what kind of performance do they give, Paul? Stop giving your opinion, Sean.
Well, I think all performances are good, and as Gemma said, the film is nicely under, which makes it bearable. But I think Norton's exceptional, and we've seen his range in other things like Happy Valley and things like he can play maniacs. He's an extraordinary actor, actually, and I think he's just superb in this. I really do.
And Daniel Lamont as the little boy, Gemma.
He's so cute. And also a big shout out to Norton's accent. I had to Google where he was from, just in case he was a secret Irish person that we haven't claimed. I think that's another, it's not an easy one to nail.
No, it certainly isn't, and he does it really well. But again, it's the simplicity of the story in lots of ways, and you'd be made of stone if you didn't cry at this.
There's something wrong with you if you don't cry at the end of it.
I think so. And not because you've been manipulated, but because it's just an incredibly sad story. Yeah. Stars from you, Paul?
Four and a half even, maybe, Sean. Throw and a half there.
Oh, it's the cuddly toy. You're still not annoyed at that couple for not giving him back the cuddly toy. 4.5 out of 5 from Paul. And what are you saying, Gemma?
Four for me.
Four,
I thought it was
you.
Beautiful.
Thought it was beautiful. Okay, that's nowhere special. Watch out for it. It certainly, you'll be in bits at the end of it. Bring the Kleenex for that one. Finally then, Deerskin. This is a very French story of a man, Georges, finds peculiar meaning and personality in his new jacket.
Yeah.
Now explain, Paul Whittington.
I have a feeling that this is going to be a sort of Marmite-y film for people, because some people just won't go along with it. Quentin Dupieux, who directed it, he's done this before. One of his previous films was about a car tire that kills people. But I actually went with this and really enjoyed it. People will remember Jean Dujardin from The Artist, this very suave, handsome French person, but he's very different in this. He's Georges, who he travels across country to buy this. It's actually hideous, the jacket, but it's this sort of bum freezer kind of deerskin suede jacket with fringes like a bad country and western singer would wear, but he thinks he's lovely in it. And when the little fella he buys it off says, "Quelle allure," and Georges totally agrees with this and he thinks he's wonderful. But and when he gets to this hotel in the Pyrenees, he looks in the mirror and for ages, and you're reminded of Taxi Driver, and that's not the only time you're reminded of Taxi Driver.
There are definitely memories. You'll be nudged toward Taxi Driver, but I think you'll also be nudged towards, for me anyway, Yorgos Lanthimos and The Lobster and that type of film. That kind of surreality is in there, Gemma.
Definitely. There's a bunch of different metaphors people could take from it. I definitely leaned into the midlife crisis one, and I think actually Dujardin's performance, that kind of awkward, earnest, but trying so hard performance, and in a very, very subtle way. And like that as well, like he really believes in this jacket. Like this jacket is the start of his new life. He leaves his wife, he leaves his family. He starts up in a new town to finally be himself. Like there's a kind of emotion, even though the whole story is ridiculous. The premise is relatively weak because it is just about a jacket, wanting to be the only jacket in the world. And George is facilitating that. There's a sort of emotional deep truth to it, which makes it more watchable than your average surrealist comedy.
Yeah, but we're in the world of Flat Eric here as well. Who explained Flat Eric to us, Gemma, and what the link to Flat Eric is in the film?
So if anyone remembers maybe a Levi's ad from 1999, and there's this repetitive house dance music that sounds not dissimilar to Daft Punk, and there's this strange yellow puppet who's, I don't, he's a bit of a hard-living puppet. Like he lives a bit of a rough lifestyle, and a series of music videos he features in. So that's Mr. Oizo, and that's another stage name for the musician who is also the director, Quentin Dupois, of this very strange film. So he obviously lives in a realm of creativity and madness.
And to what extent then do you think, Paul, is there actually some kind of satirical story or tale being told here? Is there some analogy that I'm missing, or is it pure surreality for the sake of surreality?
Well, it's partly that. It's partly only also a film about films. A lot of horror films, most horror films, use cheap tricks and nastiness to evoke responses, and it sort of does that, but it's commenting on it as it does it. I think for me, above all, by the way, Adele Anel, who's the bar. She's terrific in it.
Yeah, so
as well.
This is a character that he meets in a bar who says she's a film editor, and he's pretending he's a film.
And she instantly believes him, even though he's very bad at spoofing. But above all, I think it's a comedy. It's a very funny film, and actually, even Dujardin manages to make, when the jacket starts talking to him, like Maria, like you can see he's talking. The jacket starts going, George, and it's very insistent, like an annoying sort of person in a bar, and it starts telling him to do things. But it's I just found it very funny. I don't think everybody will, but I did.
I think there is a touch of the Marmite about it. You'll either run with it or run away from it in some ways. Yeah. Are you in one or other of those camps, Gemma?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. It's silly, dark fun. I would. And definitely not for everyone. Like, I wouldn't be recommending this to my book club or anything like that.
No, they'd kill you.
and then your man would go off and make a film about it. And there'd be a joke in the film about the fact that your book club killed you. So what does that mean in terms of stars from you, Gemma?
So 3.5 stars.
3.5 from you. And what are you saying, Paul?
4 from me, yeah.
4 from Paul for Deerskin. Deerskin is at the IFI. Nowhere Special, which is the middle film we spoke about, is also at the IFI and available on Curzon Home Cinema. And Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised, is released in selected cinemas. Born in Belgium in 1903, Georges Simenon, best known as the creator of Inspector Maigret, the French star of 75 detective novels, multiple screen adaptations where actors like Rowan Atkinson and Michael Gambon made the role their own. Simenon also wrote what he called his roman d'or, or hard novels, dark psychological tales beloved of authors such as John Banville. Betty is one such novel, a portrait of a traumatised, hard-drinking 28-year-old living alone in Paris, whose past threatens to engulf her. Originally published in 1961, it was made into a film by Claude Chabrol in 1992, and Betty has just been reissued by Penguin. John Self has been rereading it for us, and he joins me now. Betty comes 40 years after Simenon published his debut, Au Point des Arches. He was 17 when he published that debut. Give us a context of where it sits in, of where Betty sits in that output, because we're talking about 400 novels, in fact, in total.
We are indeed. I mean, he was quite a cottage industry, or not even a cottage industry, an industry to himself. Mm. And this is one of the, and the first novel you mentioned, these were the very early pulp novels that he wrote. And believe it or not, he wrote about 200 of those in 8 years. Didn't put his own name to them until he started writing the Maigret books in 1930, I think. And then he started to really get into his sort of his professional shift, if you like. So he wrote 75 Maigret novels, as you said, and and Penguin Books have been reissuing those one a month for the last 6 years or so. And now they've started doing the Roman Dour as well. So this is, it's relatively late in his career, 1961. He was well into his stride by then, and it's much more of a, I suppose you might call it a psychological study, even maybe a psychological thriller of this young woman who is drinking, drifting, some traumatic experience, which we learn about through the course of the book, and how she responds to this older woman who rescues her, and whether she's maybe not necessarily as grateful to her as she might be.
And how typical is Betty of the Roman Dour of Simenon? Is it kind of the perfect example of that particular style of Simenon writing?
Not necessarily. I mean, there's two answers to that. I mean, the first is that it's probably not his best or necessarily one to start with. And in that sense, I suppose Penguin have been issuing not just the Simenon books, but also earlier some of the Roman Dour before this. So we're probably getting into the ones that aren't necessarily a priority now. But they're still very readable. The other point is that he was very varied in what he did. So he did one of his novels was the Crow House, one of his best. That was about immigration and quite a political novel for him. There was Dirty Snow, which is a very dark one about a young man on a rampage of violence. So they were quite varied. But what they all had in common was this profound interest in human nature. He was in the Maigret books and in the Roman Dour, he was very, very interested in how people work. And one critic said, he doesn't solve crimes, he solves people. He was very, very pleased whenever people wrote to him and said, I really see myself in your books, or, you're an author who really understands me. He was only interested in the characters. I mean, the plots came almost secondary to him.
And do you think that the Maigret books kind of bled into the Roman Dour in terms of that interest in humanity, or was it the other way around?
It was the Maigret books that he started with, or once he decided to put his own name to the books. That was the, and I think he felt those were sort of his entertainments, as he saw them, to sort of put a sort of a Graham Greenish twist on it. And he saw the Roman Dour as the ones that he would be remembered for. He was quite wrong, of course, in the sense that he's now famous for Maigret. But he certainly took the Roman Dour a little bit more seriously. But, despite that, he didn't take long to write these books. They were, as you can tell by the number that he wrote, he would write a book in 11 days. It was 8 days to write it and then 3 days to revise it. It was, after that, he said it was such an intense and stressful experience. He would be physically drained after that.
Yeah, well, I mean, it must have been a very intensive 11-day period. But he had a peculiar attitude. Obviously, writer's block, if you have 400 novels, I don't think writer's block had caused him any real difficulties at any point in his life. But if he took a break from, in that 11-day period, if he took a break from a book for a couple of days, he had a peculiar attitude to things.
Yeah, he threw it away. He just he gave up on it. And I suppose, if you've got that sort of facility for continuous invention, then it's maybe not so problematic. There's a story which we don't really know if it's true or not, but it's certainly said of him, which was that Alfred Hitchcock one day rang him and he was told, "Sorry, Mr. Simenon can't come to the phone. He's just started a new book." And Hitchcock said, "That's okay, I'll wait."
Hitchcock, of course, would have the answer ready, wouldn't he, for such a statement? But that aspect of being able to write, it would seem as if he sat down, he sat down for the 11 days and literally went at it and then revised for 3 days. Betty is the one that you've been reading. Does it read with that kind of ease and that kind of flow, which seems to be suggested?
I mean, to some extent it does. I mean, all of his novels are quite heavily dialogue-driven. I mean, that's why, as you said, Claude Chabrol filmed this one and the Maigrets have been televised and filmed umpteen times. So there is a certain speed and flow in it. And you don't really read him for, you don't pause on the page for the beauty of the prose. There was one critic said he doesn't have, Simenon's books don't have best pages. He just has best novels where everything hangs together without a single scene. But, he was highly respected. You mentioned John Banville, but, André Gide, William Faulkner, Muriel Spark, Anita Bruckner was a huge fan. So, he certainly had a lot of fans among what you might call more serious and respected writers.
Yeah, and as you say, Banville often talked about Georges Simenon, particularly, and the Roman Dour when he embarked on his Benjamin Black phase of writing, although everything is under the Banville name now. But can you see an influence from Simenon across those several writers that you spoke about recognizing his work as of being of a high quality?
I don't really think so, to be honest. I think they respected, I suppose, maybe in the fact that these were all writers who took a long time over the books. They maybe sort of respected and even envied his facility and his speed. And they loved the stories and they all had different favourites. But I don't think there's necessarily a huge direct influence among them, no.
Now, this reissuing by Penguin, you know, the cynic would have to say, well, why are you reissuing them? Other than, you know, if people came to Maigret and then they find about these Roman Dürer and they're going to try to be completist about things. Is that what's going on here? Or is there, are they speaking, do these novels speak to today in some way that perhaps they didn't speak, you know, or that is reflecting back to what they did in the 60s when they were first written in the case of Betty?
Well, there's an element of that, you know, and I mentioned The Cruel House earlier, which is, you know, which talks about sort of immigration and things like that, and, you know, so issues that can still be contemporary. But as I said earlier, the big thing for Simenon was human nature, and that's something that never really changes. From a practical point of view, I suppose, what Penguin did with the Maigrets was that they were all fresh translations. So, you know, the earlier translations had been maybe a little bit ropey, and in some cases, in fact, the endings had been changed. So they wanted to reissue them all with new translations, and that's what's happening now with the Roman Dürer as well.
I suppose, yes. I missed that vital component, of course, that we are talking about translations. So are these all... These reissues are also new translations.
Exactly, yes.
And do you get a sense in the reading of the translation that you've been reading of Betty, does the language have more of a 21st century feel to it than the mid-20th century feel that would be there in the original?
I think it does. You know, it's I didn't read the previous translation of Betty, but it certainly feels like a modern book. And you know, you have to be very careful. Translators sometimes can get a little bit slangy and a little bit localized, you know, and sometimes translate things into British English or American English rather than just a sort of a standard English that doesn't give a flavor of a different country. You know, we have to remember it's still a book that's set in France and supposed to have that French flavor. But you don't really get any sense of that sort of localization from this translation or from the other Simenons that I've read.
He died in Switzerland in 1989. Obviously, 400 books, you wouldn't expect them all to be masterpieces. But what is the enduring appeal, do you think, of Simenon?
I think it is his understanding of people, you know. He's a fascinating character in himself, you know. So the books are good reads, but the more you read about him, the more you find him fascinating. You know, he had the speed with which he wrote his books speaks a sort of pathological obsessiveness in his life elsewhere, you know, where he moved house 32 times. He used to say that he would live in a house and then he would start looking around it, getting a feeling of what he called emptiness, look at his surroundings and ask himself, why am I here? And move on, you know. So he had this, he was a fascinating figure in himself.
Well, there's a PhD study to link the books of Simenon to the house in which they were written and see if the various houses gave a different style. Do I hear you biting at the chomping at the bit to get into that study? I don't think so, John. Now, just before we finish up on Betty itself, I think you have some reservations around Betty as a novel. What are they?
Well, it's a little bit slow moving as far as his novels go, you know. And if you're going to go for that thing where it's a 140 page novel, his aim was always to write books that people literally could not put down, so that they would read them in one sitting. And there's certainly the length to do that. This one isn't so much like that, you know. We do get a lot of psychological insight into Betty. It's not really a great page turner, I don't think. And the ending is quite satisfying. There's certainly a certain amount of conflict without giving anything away. But I just don't think it's really up there with the greatest page turners that he wrote.
Well, let's get you to finish up then by maybe suggesting to us both a Maigret novel and a non-Maigret, a Roman Dürer, that we might think of as, you know, a starting point or a good place to get stuck into the work of Simenon as the summer holidays are upon us.
Yeah, well, you can start with the first Maigret, which is Peter the Latvian, and non-Maigrets, I think. The Cruel House is a great one. That was Anita Bruckner's personal favourite. It's the one about a brother who comes back from another country and sort of causes a bit of havoc in a home as he immigrates back into the country.
Great. Well, thanks for that. Those suggestions this evening. That's John Self and John speaking to us about Georges Simenon in general and indeed the novel Betty, which is being republished, as I said, by Penguin. Did you think I'd open in the machine? No. To save my money for security, got a stock of walking up and on the street. Says he's Satan and he'd like to meet. I bought a secret house when I was 17. I
haven't had a party since I got the keys. Had a pretty boy over, but he couldn't stay. On his way, I made him sign an NDA.
NDA, the title of the song, acronym for Non-Disclosure Agreement, from American singer Billie Eilish. Fifth and latest single from her second studio album, Happier Than Ever, which is scheduled for release at the end of the month, July the 30th. NDA dealing with Eilish's battle for privacy in the wake of her fame and her relationships in the same context. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy, Paula Shields Research, Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator, Jamie Doyle was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Olin McGowan. I will speak to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1.